Please help me with a warm welcome to Ambassador Ron Dermer.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here at such a prestigious club, and I'm going to break Groucho Marx's rule to never go to a club that would have him as a member. He didn't say never go to a club that would have him as a speaker, but I want to thank you because I know how prestigious this club is and how people from my country and from across the world have had the opportunity and the privilege really to address you. You mentioned a bunch of some of my famous predecessors, Abba Ibn Moshe Arad, and it's an honor for me to be here. I want to just recognize one person who wasn't recognized in addition to all the elected officials. You see, a couple months ago, I got the opportunity to join another club. It was called the Churchill Fellows Club. And I gave a speech down in Fulton, Missouri. Those of you who are history buffs may know that Winston Churchill gave his famous Iron Curtain speech there. And every year they recognize and include in this club of Churchill Fellows a few new members. And I was honored to become a Churchill Fellow down in St. Louis. But one of my fellow fellows, actually two of my fellow fellows are here today. They're the ones wearing the nice medallions. But I want to recognize one of them because he's a local here who has done not just great things for Detroit, but great things for America, and that's Morton Harris. Maybe you could stand up for 1 second, Morton. Now I'm gonna tell you why you're applauding. Morton Harris is 97 years young. He flew the most combat missions in the United States military over Berlin. He was shot down twice, and he was rescued at sea. And I just want to thank you on behalf of a fellow democracy in the heart of the Middle East for everything you and your colleagues did to defend freedom around the world. Thank you very much. I want to thank Mark Davidoff and the president of the Michigan-Israel Business Alliance, and really thank everyone here. I know this is a very diverse group, but I want to thank all of you who are here who are committed to strengthening the economic partnership between Israel and Michigan. Now, most of the time in my day job, I speak about Iran and the dangers of Iran. I speak about the effort, Israel's effort to advance peace with all our neighbors, and a host of other hot-button issues. And I don't really get the opportunity that often to speak about the Israeli economy. But it's a remarkable story, and I think it's a story that holds within it great lessons for Michigan and great lessons for countries around the world. And I want to talk about that transformation that has occurred in Israel's economy over the last couple of decades. Now, some of you may not know the history of Israel's economy. Israel was founded as a socialist country. Founded. The leaders of Israel, pretty much for the first two decades, were proud socialists. Now, that ethos was extremely powerful, and it was an effort really to transform the condition of the Jewish people from being merchants in Europe and elsewhere to working the land and being laborers. And there was an effort to almost enforce socialism on the country. And when I first moved to Israel in 1996, I discovered that capitalism was actually a dirty word in Israel. You could attack a political opponent for being a capitalist. I don't know if that's true yet in America. I hope not. And I'll explain why I hope not in a minute. But in Israel, to be a capitalist, you didn't really have proud capitalists walking around. There was always something to sort of be somewhat embarrassed about. Now, I don't want to debate with the founder, the first Prime Minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, about whether socialism was good during that time, which needed great centralization of power. And Israel really was born in a unique set of circumstances. Immediately a war happened, our War of Independence. Five countries attacked us. And so maybe at that point you needed a great centralization of power. But I do know this, that socialism and genius do not go together. There is no greater straitjacket for genius than socialism. Look at the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union led the world for many years in scientific and mathematic achievement. They had great Nobel Prize-winning scientists and mathematicians. They could not produce anything because they didn't have a system that would unleash that genius. And what happened in Israel is this remarkable story where we're a socialist country and you had this strange thing happening where Jews were wildly successful economically everywhere in the world except for Israel. And so people thought, well, maybe Israel got all the lemons. Maybe all the plums went somewhere else. And then something amazing happened. Some of those lemons moved from Israel and they went to Silicon Valley and they went to New York and Boston and certain places in Europe and maybe a few right here in Detroit. And then they magically turned into plums. So it might be that we had a system that was stifling innovation and stifling creativity. And the story of Israel in the last 20 years is the unleashing of Israel's economic potential, liberalizing in a dramatic way Israel's economy. It actually started a little bit in the mid-80s. We had pretty high inflation in Israel. I know people, when they think of high inflation, they think 10%, 15%, 20%. You remember the late 70s here in the United States. Well, Israel had 400% inflation. And economic stabilization policies were begun then, and that was really the beginning when people understood the collapse of the old system, where you began to move to a freer economy. But the person who has actually done the most to unleash this creativity is the current Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, he has been either Prime Minister or Finance Minister for 15 of the last 20 years. So he has left a great stamp on Israel's economy. And in his first term as Prime Minister, he did something where, at the time, Israel had currency controls. You couldn't actually take money out of Israel. And we had very, very strict controls and regulations. And the Prime Minister decided, well, we need to free this up. We need to allow money and capital to flow back in and out. And people were very worried about it because they thought the shekel would collapse and that all the money would flow out of Israel. And he went against the advice of many of the professionals. That may sound familiar. And he decided to free up Israel's currency. And money did not flow out of Israel, it flowed into Israel because people wanted to invest in this economy that was becoming more and more free. But the difference in his first term as Prime Minister to what happened when he was actually Finance Minister is that he didn't have a crisis. An economic crisis lends itself to great reform. It is hard politically to do reforms when there is not a crisis, because there's all these vested economic interests and it becomes a nearly impossible task. Well, in his second, in his term as finance minister, when he came back to political life after ending his first term as prime minister, he was a few years out of political life, he came back as finance minister, Israel was facing an economic catastrophe. We had 12% unemployment, we had negative growth for 2 years, not a quarter, two quarters of negative growth, 2 years of negative growth. We had government spending that was 55% of GDP. Those of you who are economists here, you know that's a pretty big number. We had a debt to GDP ratio that was over 100%. There was a fear that a major bank could collapse. And this was at the end of 2002, the beginning of 2003. And most people at the time thought the reason why Israel has this problem is because we had a collapse of NASDAQ, you may remember, here in 2000, and Israel's a real high-tech economy. And the second thing is we had what's called an intifada, this sort of terrorist war against Israel, that they thought those combinations, the collapse of NASDAQ and this terrorism that was happening in Israel, that is what was squeezing Israel's economy. Well, I'm going to appoint any of you finance minister of Israel, and you come and you see these economic numbers that are terrible, and people are telling you, let me explain to you what's happening. NASDAQ has collapsed, and there's a terrorist war. So what are you going to do? Well, the answer is you go on vacation, because as finance minister, there's really nothing you're going to do about the collapse of NASDAQ, and there's nothing you can do more than any other minister in the Israeli government about dealing and confronting the terror challenge that we face. But he took a very, very different view, and he said, no, those may exacerbate the problem, but the real problem is that we're not a free enough economy. We have to use this opportunity of this crisis to free up the economy. Now, what is very hard in selling economic reform, you said there's some state representatives and state senators here, so very hard to sell economic reforms. Very hard to explain economic concepts in a very, very simple way. Because actually, a lot of economics is counterintuitive. And those of you who are economists in the room or have studied economics know that. But it's very hard to sell it to a public. So he faces these terrible economic numbers, and he decides he's going to do a massive push to free up the whole economy across the board. Cut spending, cut taxes, privatize, pension reform, privatize a lot of the national industries. But how are you going to sell it to the Israeli public? Well, in Israel, we don't have the example of lemonade stands. We don't have that entrepreneurial image. But there is something that Israelis, virtually all Israelis, share. And it's the experience of the army in Israel. Unfortunately, we have not known a single day of peace in 70 years. We are fortunate to have made peace agreements with two of our Arab neighbors, Jordan and Egypt, and we hope that we can reach peace agreements with all our Arab neighbors. But we've had to maintain a strong army for the last 70 years, which has actually driven our innovation as well, which is another story. But everyone has this experience of going to the military in Israel. Well, in basic training in the military in Israel, what they have is something called the elephant race. And what you do is you stand in a row, like a dais right here, and what happens is the person takes one person to the left of the person who's standing in the row, goes on the shoulders of that person. And then you match up in pairs. And so everybody has somebody standing on their shoulders. And then the sergeant blows the whistle, and people start moving forward. So the prime minister says this. This is national television, a press conference about Israel's economic reforms. It's about 5-6 o'clock at night. Evening news is breaking into what the prime minister is going to announce. And he starts talking about the elephant race that he had when he was in basic training in the army. And he said, I was standing there, and I had a guy who was pretty big, and I put him on my shoulders. The guy to the right of me was one of the biggest guys in the unit, and he had a tiny guy on his shoulders. And the guy to the left of me was one of the smallest guys, and he had a huge guy on his shoulders. And he said, the sergeant blew the whistle, and I plodded ahead. The guy on the left of me took two steps and collapsed, and the guy on the right on me shot off like a cannon. And he said to the people of Israel, all economies are these pairs of a public sector that sits on the back of a private sector. And if that public sector gets too big, the private sector is going to collapse under its weight. And he used that image actually to explain Israel's problem, that our government had gotten way too big, our taxes and regulations way too burdensome, and that he had to do what he could in order to get along in the race. And the way it was called in Israel, believe it or not, the fat man, thin man presentation, because he said all economies are there's fat guys and thin guys. And if a fat guy is really on top of a thin guy, this guy is going to collapse. That's what he called it. And you would go and speak to Israeli cab drivers and Israeli shopkeepers, and you ask them about the fat man and thin man, they totally got it. Now I understand it. And he says, well, the government's too fat, and we got to put it on a diet. We got to cut spending. The guy in the bottom is too thin, and we got to actually strengthen him, and we're going to do that by actually lowering taxes and lowering the regulatory burdens. And then when a guy walks ahead, he can immediately fall into a ditch, right? So we got to actually remove the barriers to competition. And what he did was he put in place all of these economic reforms. We had a huge spending. He capped it at 1% growth, and that is more or less held for 15 years. Now, as Israel's economy grows, it has reduced the size of government spending. Today, it's about 40% of GDP. He cut taxes. We used to have a 64% marginal tax rate in Israel. I know there's a lot of debate about your income taxes here. Imagine 64%. He lowered that to 49%, and then he lowered 49 to 44. He took the corporate tax rate and reduced it from 36 to 25, and then another reform that was going to reduce it from 25 to 18. And unlike you did here, by the way, which is something I'd recommend for state government or elsewhere, is he did it over many years. He actually didn't do it in one swoop. He reduced it sort of, in the case of corporate taxes, 11% over about 3 to 4 years. But what happens, the markets immediately see the impact down the road. So it gets discounted almost right away. So you have the full benefit of the tax reform if you show that you're politically determined to do it, but you don't have the impact on your budget immediately. And in Israel, even though it hasn't been the case everywhere in the world, the reduction in tax rates actually dramatically increased tax revenues in Israel. So the Laffer curve was alive and well over in Israel. And as I said, he did welfare reform. He reformed our pension system. He lowered raised the retirement age from 65 to 67 for men, from about 60 to 64 for women, gradually over time. And he privatized a bank, a phone carrier, the national refinery, national airlines. And the results have been Israel's had 15 years of growth at about 4%. Our unemployment is around 4%. And our debt to GDP ratio today is under 60. Okay? So we have seriously put our fiscal house in order. But the thing is, with good fiscal policy and good monetary policy, you will keep yourself from going broke. But you will not get rich. Not as an individual, and not as a country. To be wealthy, once you've achieved certain level of GDP per capita, you have to actually have capacities for innovation. And Israel has those in spades. We are in a 21st century of knowledge, a 21st century where the ability to create conceptual products are going to drive the future. And Israel is poised, as no other country in the world is, to seize that future. 42 out of the 50 leading high-tech companies in the world have R&D facilities in Israel. 42 out of 50. So you have the Intels, and you have the Ciscos, and Apple, and Microsoft. And we have more companies listed on NASDAQ, is a race sometimes between us and the Chinese, of any company, any country outside the United States. Think about that. Israel, if you don't know, is a country the size of New Jersey with fewer than 9 million people. We have more high-tech companies than any European country by far. We have more high-tech startups in absolute terms than any European country by far. Not just in relative terms, in absolute terms. And Israel has become a global technological power, a global power in many fields. One is agriculture. In Israel, we developed drip irrigation. And that technology is exported all over the world, in Africa, in Asia, and it's transforming a lot of lives and a lot of communities all around the world. We, in Israel, we've come up with a certain technology regarding milking of cows. This may surprise you, but the cow that produces the most milk is not Dutch, it's not from Wisconsin, it's a kosher cow over in Israel, because we have, I guess, to the last, whatever it's called, to the last squeeze there, they have computerized everything, and now a lot of countries that have big dairy industries are looking to Israel to help actually improve their efficiency. Israel is a global technological power in water. There were people 20, 30 years ago who thought that waters and the lack of water were going to cause wars in the Middle East, because there's not a lot of water in Israel. We don't get a lot of rainfall. Today, our population is 10 times bigger than it was in 1948, and we get less rainfall. But Israel doesn't have a water problem, because you can make more water, because we've mastered a desalination and all the technologies associated, and water conservation. There was actually our national economic advisor said to his counterpart in the United States, he said, you know, I can take a 1,600 time longer shower than you can. It wasn't a comment on his hygiene habits. He says, I'm explaining to you why. Because in the United States, you recycle a little more than 1% of your water. In Israel, we recycle almost 90% of our water, 80 times that. Number two in the world, by the way, is Spain at about 25%. So think about how dramatic that is, 90% of the water. And then what happens is we take the recycled water and we use it in drip irrigation. And if you don't know what that technology is, you have these hoses and they put holes in those hoses and water drips out onto the plant that is planted exactly the same distance as you have in the hose. And so you have spray. I see these commercials that show the lush countryside of America with this spraying of these lush fields. I'm thinking, oh my God, look how much water they're wasting doing it. Drip irrigation is 20 times as effective. So take 80 times 20, 1,600 times longer, because we've mastered water conservation. And that's another technology that people around the world are really interested in. You have drug research in Israel, where we're pushing the envelope to cure diseases like Parkinson's and multiple sclerosis. There are new technologies, and I saw recently there was an initiative to try to get American patients a right to try bill, I suppose, that will allow them to look at different technologies around the world. I would bet that Israel may be the number one destination for some of those drugs and life-saving technologies. We've got pills that we put with cameras in them that can actually photograph and help doctors photograph entire internal systems before they even have to go into surgery. We've got innovation that allows paraplegics to walk for the first time, an exoskeleton that was developed in Israel. And these remarkable things, like simple technologies like Waze. Anyone use Waze getting over here this morning? Yeah. So that's an Israeli technology literally helping get you to where you need to go. But this is really only the beginning of what you're going to see. Because we have unleashed Israel's genius and Israel's innovation, you're going to see that the technologies of the future, many of them will be centered in Israel. I'll give you an example of one of those technologies, cyber. Israel, as I said, is almost 9 million people. That's 0.1% of the world's population. The last 2 years, Israel accounted for 20% of global investment in cybersecurity. Think about that. 20% of private investment in global in cybersecurity is in Israel. So we are punching 200 times above our weight. So in cyber, Israel is not a small country the size of New Jersey. In cyber, Israel's bigger than a China. And I think you're going to see this move forward. The governor went and spoke at our cyber security, cyber tech, a conference, and signed an MOU, a memorandum of understanding, between Israel and the state of Michigan. And also did something besides signing an agreement, started funding this cooperation to the tune of $500,000 a year. And I think that's very smart, because it's going to allow people in Michigan to take advantage of all that innovation that's happening in Israel. A second area where we are, again, taking the world where it's going is in autonomous vehicles. I understand that in Michigan, cars are also part of the economy, right? So I got that memo. Well, Israel's got 500 companies, startups in autonomous vehicles. 500. 10 years ago, we had zero. Now we have 500. We have a car industry in Israel. Who knew? We haven't built a single car. We won't build a certain car. But all the technology and the value added of cars that's moving more and more towards those technologies, that's all being developed in Israel. And General Motors has R&D facilities there. I think they employ some 300 people in Israel. And I would strongly recommend to the car companies, I understand General Motors has competition, I would recommend that the other car companies go and establish centers in Israel to take advantage of that. And competition will definitely breed excellence, and it will help all those companies, and I think benefit the American auto industry by those partnerships. What happened last year is that Intel bought an Israeli company, Mobileye. Mobileye is a company that develops technologies that prevents you from hitting things, like your mother-in-law when you're backing out of the driveway. Right? I don't know if everyone wants to miss hitting their mother-in-law. I personally like my mother-in-law. But you have these technologies that are sensors on a car. Intel bought Mobileye for $15 billion, which is even a lot of shekels. And not only that, it gave Mobileye's operation in Israel the keys to all their own autonomous vehicle work around the world. Because they say, we haven't seen a place like this with this type of technology and the ability to apply those technologies better than in Israel. So it's making a huge difference. Another area is in gas and oil. We used to say that Moses was a great leader but a lousy navigator. because he took us to the one place in the Middle East that doesn't have oil and gas. Well, it turns out we found gas, a lot of gas, in the Mediterranean. And the reason why I think that's important is that I believe Israel will be a center pretty soon, within 5 or 10 years, for innovations in natural gas. We never put our best minds on those problems because we never had to deal with it before. But now we're getting that gas when it's not only changing our economy, now we're exporting gas to our Arab neighbors. How many of you thought 10 years ago Israel would be exporting gas to our Arab neighbors? But it's happening. It's happening with Egypt and it's happening with Jordan. And I think that bodes very well for the future. And another area that I would keep in mind, those of you who are in the healthcare industry. Healthcare in Israel, we keep our costs actually pretty low. It's only about 7% of our GDP. In the US, it's about 17% of the GDP. And everybody in Israel is covered. And healthcare is pretty good. In fact, in all these indices that measure health, longevity, it's higher in Israel than it is in the United States. And it's not because there's no tension in Israel. But infant mortality, incidence of disease, our numbers are actually pretty good across the board. In fact, I was asking people for years, why is Israel so good at healthcare and why do we do it so cheaply? And he gave me an interesting answer. He said, because Jews are hypochondriacs. Now you're laughing. Now I'm going to explain to you why that's true. He says, what happens is everybody's covered and there are very low payments to go and visit a doctor. It only costs about 10 shekels, which is about $3. You can go to a doctor, and so what happens is the second somebody gets sniffles or something or a problem in their throat, they go over and go see a doctor. Healthcare costs rise exponentially if you allow a problem to fester. And because everybody's rushing to do it, so my advice to you as a state is cheap co-payments for visits to the doctor, you may end up saving your state a lot of money in healthcare expenses. But I think Israel is going to be a major source for healthcare innovation, because we are unique in that we have an extremely diverse population. You have Jews coming from 100 different countries around the world. And we have records, medical records that go back decades. Other countries don't have that. We're the only one, I think there's one of the Baltic states has it, but not as long, and they're not as diverse a population. So Israel will become one of the leading beta testing sites for all sorts of healthcare innovations. And with our other technological capacities that we have, I think that's going to be a remarkable recipe for success. Now, in closing, you know the history about Israel. So what is the secret to Israel's success? There are books, The Startup Nation, and other books that talk about the remarkable Israeli economy and the innovation. And we have delegations literally coming to Israel every single day asking, what are you doing so well that we're not doing? How can we become more like you? What are your secrets? Well, I think in thinking about why Israel has succeeded, it's really a three-part cocktail. The first part is that we've become a free economy. We have liberated our economy, and it has unleashed the remarkable potential of our people. But that will only get you so far. Just having a free economy, by the way, it's not a bad idea. For most countries, they can get growth for a period of time. But as I said, you need innovation. And Israel combines that free economy with something else, which is we have true genius among our population. And one of the things that has enabled us to take advantage of that genius is our unfortunate security situation. Because we have this military, our best and brightest don't go into MIT. They go into the elite units of Israel's military, and they get exposed to the latest technologies at an age of 18. By the time they leave at 21 or 22, they are in a different place than most of their peers around the world. And that unfortunate security situation has actually enabled us to have something of an innovation advantage among other countries in the world. So you got genius, which I think is spread around everywhere in some degree or another. You've got a free market, but here we have a secret ingredient, and that's the third one. And this really is the key. This is the special sauce. So this is going to hard for me to reveal it, but it's not something that's going to be easily copied. The secret ingredient is in our name. Does anyone here know what Israel means? Israel? It's a word from the Bible. Jacob wrestled with an angel. And his name was changed from Jacob to Israel. And that's the father, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the father of the 12 tribes. Israel means to wrestle with God. That's what it means. Now, if you have a people that's going to wrestle with God, you're certainly going to wrestle with guys in Silicon Valley on who's going to make a better mousetrap. We have in Israel, there's a word for it, a Yiddish word for it, that's very common, chutzpah. What chutzpah means is gall, is daring, the willingness to challenge conventional ideas, a culture of skepticism. The Nobel Prizes, of which we have quite a few in Israel, they don't go to the smartest person in the class. The Nobel Prize goes to the smartest person in the class who's willing to challenge the professor. And we have a lot of people in Israel who are willing to challenge, are willing to create, are willing to innovate, and are not comfortable with the status quo. And this combination of genius and free markets and chutzpah is creating this enormous opportunity for Israel and enormous opportunities for everyone who partners with Israel, like the state of Michigan. If an Israeli ambassador was here 30 years ago and you had a number who were, there's a videotape, but I doubt that they were saying 30 years ago that Israel was going to become a global technological power. And if they did, you wouldn't believe them. But Israel has become a global technological power, and we are a leader in all of these areas. And I think, given the fact that our markets are still free, that we do still have this capacity for genius within our people, and that chutzpah and Israel are basically synonymous, I believe that we are only at the beginning, and Israel's best economic days are ahead, and all of you who partner with Israel, no matter what your industries are, I think will have the ability to help your companies, help your state, and seize the future. Thank you very much. Sure.
Senator, thank you so much for your comments. We have a lot of great questions. I know that because I wrote them. So we're going to try to do this in the lightning round if we can because we're short on time. So you mentioned your moments at the Churchill Weekend, and you mentioned Mort Harris, and Clark Durant is also here, who was also inducted. Your speech was actually entitled Churchill and Israel. What would Churchill say today about Israel and the role that it plays in the world?
Churchill would say what he said when he was the head of the opposition in England and Israel was established. And his old friend Chaim Weizmann, who became the first president of Israel, sent him a note thanking him for his steadfast support for the Jewish people's right for a national home. For so many decades, Churchill was a great friend of the Jewish people and a great friend of Israel, but he was not the sitting prime minister when Israel was established. He was in the opposition once again. And Churchill responded to Chaim Weizmann with three words. When he responded to Chaim Weizmann, he said, after learning of Israel's establishment, he responded, "The light grows." Churchill would see Israel as a great force of light in a very, very dark region of the world. We are a democracy in the heart of the Middle East. We are not a perfect democracy. And everyone who's trying to measure Israel up against the standard of perfection will find that we, like all countries, fall short. But we are the most beleaguered democracy on earth. And democratic values, if you don't realize, I think many do, are actually tested under fire. That's when it counts. I remember in this country on September 12th, 2001, when there was a great sense that another attack may be imminent. And the feeling that people had of wanting to protect their security and maybe being willing to give up some civil liberties in order to protect the securities, because there's always a balance that you have to find. And then over time, as the danger recedes and the fear recedes, you obviously go back and you want to secure those civil liberties. And that's the way it should be in a democracy. It's a natural process. But understand that Israel has been in September 12 for 70 years. And I marvel, as a son of America, this great nation, I marvel at Israel's democracy, that we've been able to uphold our values under conditions that no democracy on earth has faced for so long a time. You look at American history, you look at different periods where there were great security challenges, and things that happened, and decisions that were made in real time, decisions that later people come to regret. But Israel's in that real time for 70 years. And so I think Churchill would see Israel as a great force, an anchor of freedom and democracy, and he would see Israel as a great font of innovation, changing the world in all the fields that I talked about, in agriculture, in water, in cyber, in high tech, that is literally changing the world. In Africa, in Latin America, in Asia, Israel's technologies are unique. For such a small country to have made such a big imprint on the world and its innovation is truly remarkable. So I think as a great friend, he would see Israel at its 70-year anniversary and say, the light continues to grow, and it should grow stronger and stronger in the future.
This actually leads into the next question. So almost 20 years ago, Israel launched a program that we used to call Hasbara. It was an effort of the foreign ministry, I believe, to tell the story of Israel around the world, to change the image of Israel, which depending on which news outlets you watch could be somewhat tainted. How has this innovation engine, the startup nation concept, helped change Israel's image around the world?
It depends where. I think Israel has its reputation as being this innovation nation, I think, is clear around the world. In certain quarters, that becomes the only thing that people talk about. In China, small little country out there in Asia, in India and elsewhere. The focus here in the media is on a lot of times the political issues that we have, Israel's conflict with the Palestinians, what's happening regionally. What they're interested in China, and what they're interested in India, and what they're interested in many countries around the world is actually that technology and innovation. And today, Israel has ties with 160 countries around the world. I think people who had that strategy 20 years ago wouldn't have believed that this would happen. In fact, many people thought it would only happen if Israel makes peace with the Palestinians. That's going to open up the possibilities for Israel around the world. Now, we want to make peace with the Palestinians because we want to make peace with the Palestinians because we live there and we send our sons and daughters to serve in the army and defend the country, and that would be great in its own. But that's not the key, actually, to having alliances and having friends around the world. The key is that Israel become a strong power that people want to do business with, that they want that ally. Nobody makes alliances with the weak. They make alliances with the strong. And what Israel has done in the last 20 years by freeing up its economy and by strengthening its military is we have become a very important partner for countries around the world, all over. As I said, in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, and those countries really want two things. One, they want to partner with Israel on security because there's a security challenges in many countries, particularly the threats of international terrorism. And Israel, if you don't know, has one of the finest intelligence agencies in the world. And if you don't know, you didn't see that press conference that the Prime Minister gave that obtained the atomic archive from the heart of Tehran. It's a remarkable intelligence service in Israel. And so these countries want to partner with Israel, and Israel's intelligence services has actually foiled 24 major terrorist attacks just in the last few years alone around the world. And I mean major terrorist attacks, the kind that claimed over 100 lives in Paris. And other such, a blowing up of a plane. It was a plane that was going to take off from Australia. The terrorists wanted to blow up, and so we gave that information. There are many other things that happen that people don't know about, but all these countries say, hey, if I partner with Israel, I'm going to keep my own people safe. And the second thing is they want this prosperity. They've seen how Israel has made a desert bloom. We were gifted with no natural resources except the human capital that we have in our people. We don't have great national resources. We found gas. And I'm sort of happy we found it late, because if we found it early, maybe we wouldn't have developed the high-tech economy that we have. We haven't been able to rest on our laurels. We had to constantly innovate. And I think that makes us a great partner. And the best thing that we can do for Israel's diplomacy is first to remain strong, because strong countries are courted on the world stage. Weak countries are not. And the second thing is let people come to Israel and see the story for yourself. There's no better hasbara, public diplomacy for Israel, than landing in Tel Aviv and going around. And it's a free country, go where you want to go and see what you want to see. Don't go on a government-guided tour. See for yourself what's happening. And then you'll see how remarkable this country is, given the threats that we face, how free people are, that it's a place that respects women's rights, that has a gay pride parade. An hour ago, I said, you know, somebody once told me it's the biggest gay pride parade in the Middle East. I'm like, that's a low bar. It's the only gay pride parade in the Middle East. And our minorities, Israeli Arabs, are the freest Arabs in the Middle East, the only ones with real freedoms as we understand it. So yes, we have conflicts. Yes, we fall short of being a perfect society, but it's a remarkable story. And the best thing that you can do, if you're concerned about Israel's public diplomacy, is just come and see the country for yourself. And then everything they tell you on the news, you're going to start looking at a little bit differently, because you'll see, wow, this is a country that has everything stacked against it, but still succeeds and still upholds democratic values.
So this is likely our last question. As you know, we have a bunch of students here today, and they were really great earlier with you. I was very proud of the questions they asked. And like you and I, they expect a lot from this generation to leave them a world that's better than they received. And so as you think about this generation of future leaders, what would your hopes be for their futures? What would you fear? And what legacy will you leave for them as you leave the world in a better place?
For, you mean the students here?
Yeah. And in general.
Look. One thing that I'm worried about is, as a foreign ambassador, is, look, I think that America has been and continues to be the greatest force for good of any country in the world. The Jewish people know what it was like when America wasn't the preeminent power in the world, and we faced the most horrific attack in our history, the culmination of centuries of anti-Semitism that came to a head during the Holocaust, and America wasn't the preeminent power in the world. And for the last 75 years or so since World War II, America has been. And with all the problems and with all the controversies and all the difficulties, the world has become a much better place. And every free society owes a profound debt of gratitude to the United States for the sacrifices of people like Mort and others who have kept the world safe. And what happens when America recedes from the world? So the first thing I would tell those students is to believe in their country and to learn that it's a great force for good. Not a perfect country, but if you know history and you know the history of superpowers and how they treated the world, America is so unique in the history of nations for being this force for good. I mean, everyone says American imperialism. The first thing America wants when it goes somewhere is an exit strategy, right? That's not what the Romans were most concerned with when they went to another part of the world. This is a unique nation in the history of nations and a great force for good. And I think if those students believe in the ideals of this country and the creed in this country, a country that always strives to be better, that's true, but I think that no matter what their fields are, no matter what they do, they will help contribute to America continuing to be a force for good. The most dangerous thing for our fellow democracies around the world is for this nation to no longer believe in the power of its own ideals. As for me, look, I don't think the race is ever won. I think this is a mistake that people make. Maybe it's a messianic impulse. Well, you know, something will happen and all of a sudden everything will be wonderful for the next 1,000 years. We're a 4,000-year-old people, the Jewish people. Under King Solomon, we had 40 years of peace. That's about it. 1%. 99%, we faced all those other challenges. And the blessing of Israel for the Jewish people is that it has transformed the condition of the Jews to having the ability to defend themselves against attacks. Anti-Semitism hasn't ended as a problem in the world. It's coming back. In fact, the brief period after the Holocaust, people thought that's a new normal, where it was politically incorrect to be anti-Semitic. But what you have now in the return of anti-Semitism in Europe, in even in places in America, you saw that in Charlottesville and elsewhere, that's a return to the historical norm. Anti-Semitism has been around for centuries, but people thought after the Holocaust, if you don't see Nazi stormtroopers, you don't have anti-Semitism. You do, you have, and you will. The difference with Israel is that now Jews have a voice, now Jews have a refuge, and most importantly, Jews have a shield. We have the ability to fight back. My role in that, what I'd like my legacy to be, is that in my part of the race, that 100 meters in the 4x1 million race that exists, I did everything I could to pass that baton onto the next person and left the Jewish people and the Jewish future a little more secure. And I'm blessed with the opportunity and really privileged to serve Israel as ambassador in a country I love, in the land of my birth, our most important ally in the world. And if the time I leave here, I could say I did a little bit to strengthen that alliance, then I would have done my part to secure the Jewish future. Thank you.
Ambassador Dermer, while you were speaking, your mother-in-law texted me. She's going to be very careful in your driveway. So, yes, thank you so much for the honor of hosting you and for your leadership. Appreciate it. Council General, thank you for being with us. Mark Davidoff, thank you for all you did to bring the ambassador to the DEC. Thank you, and this meeting is adjourned.